You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for tuning in and happy Mother's Day to you. We have a really, really special guest this evening. It's Eleanor Coppola. Her new book, Notes on a Life, has just been published by Nantelies, which is an imprint of Doubleday. The show tonight's a bit of a departure for Mouthful in that the book is not at all about food. But just as food is an integral part of our daily lives, it is with the book as well. I didn't want to be sort of artificial about it and ask Eleanor to talk about the meals that interlace in the book. And so instead what I've done is I had her read from these meals, and you'll hear them dropped in between our conversation, which is about sort of some of the deeper things in the book. So I'm hoping in a sense it reflects what both the book and what life are like. We're going to begin with a reading from Eleanor.
The husband had left the house, and now he returned holding several chunks of pork meat in a piece of paper. Yoshiko told me the guides had given the family money from our tour expenses to buy the meat, that it is traditional to serve pork to guests and was a special treat for the family. Lunch preparations began in the dark kitchen under the light of one small dangling bulb. I stood near the door and watched. The old grandfather made numerous slow, shuffling trips outside to the back of the house, returning with handfuls of small branches he fed to the fire under the wok. I was surprised to see the husband and our guide rather than the women chopped the pork and the vegetables and beginning to cook. The husband put the pork fat into the wok, and when it had been rendered, he cooked pieces of meat in the sizzling grease. He removed the meat and stir-fried several combinations of vegetables in the hot fat. Then the cooked meat was added back in. I thought about eating all that fat, but no one in the family was overweight. I could see a large cauldron of cooked rice sitting in the shadows. The old lady pointed and waved to us as her special guest to sit on stools around a very low table in the house. Our knees poked up awkwardly around the table. She set bowls of vegetables with pork and a large bowl of rice in the middle of the table. Then she took two worn beer bottles down from a wall altar and grinned as she filled teacups with clear liquid for each of us. It was her home-brewed moonshine and tasted as if it were a cross between sake and grappa. I was hopeful it would sanitize the cup, which came straight from a tub of dirty dishes soaking in cold water in a corner of the kitchen. When I thought no one was looking, I stuck the tips of my chopsticks in the brew, too. The food, containing lots of hot, spicy green chilies and pork fat, was delicious. The husband bragged that he ate three large bowls of rice at each meal. He was slim and muscular.
Welcome to Mouthful.
Thank you.
It's just great to have you here.
Thank you.
I indulged in the luxury of doing nothing but reading this book in my spare time the last couple of weeks. And it brought up a number of things that you have brought into my life over the years. One of them being the circle of memory that you talk about in the book. I remember when you told me about that and I went down to Oakland to see it. But also another time you told me about a book, Altars and Icons, Sacred Spaces in Everyday Life. So I got that out, and I'm so touched by your sensibilities when it comes to grief and loss, and the book is in part, of course, sort of a tracing of that. But it's so much more. It's your life, and it goes back very, very early and nearly to the present. What made you decide you wanted to do this book?
Well, I've been carrying on writing these notes since my first book that came out 30 years ago with The Making of Apocalypse Now. And I had just continually these notebooks kind of piling up and piling up. And I was also caring for my mom, who actually now is 99 years old, but in her late 80s. And she had gathered every day she'd written a little kind of a meditation when she woke up in the morning. And she had them all on these index cards, and they were sort of stacking up. They were shoeboxes full and full, and we kept saying, you know, Mom, you ought to edit these, and we ought to, like, take them to a press and see. I think other people would be interested, and da-da-da. And she'd always say, oh, I'm not ready yet, and da-da-da. She'd had an excuse. And then finally she was too old, and she was in a wheelchair, and she couldn't do it. And I felt at one point I had changed computers, and I had them for safety print out all of my notes, all of my writing from the computer, and in case it got lost in this shuffle of, information. And they sent me like two huge boxes of reams and reams of reams of paper. And I said, so what's going to happen to these things? You know, my kids aren't going to want them, but they're not going to want to burn them. And I don't want to, you know, what can I do with them? And I felt like I just didn't want to sort of let it go by like my mom did, and that I should gather them together and see if I could pull them into a form that would relate to other people and put them into a book.
Well, you did a masterful job. The book is both engaging and absolutely mesmerizing. It just pulls you in part because of your voice, your narrative voice. And I'm wondering, did you go back and rewrite and edit, or did you mostly pull excerpts and edit lightly?
Well, I pulled these different pieces together, and I had some help arranging them in some kind of an order, because I liked the structure of the way we think. You know, that we think about something in the present, and then we think about something in the past. And in our minds, we sort of go back and forth. It isn't so linear.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really have a beginning and middle and end. And I didn't want to sort of begin with my childhood and end with my current life. I wanted to kind of go at it more organically. And so this was the process of putting these pieces together. And then, of course, I did try to polish them a little bit, because I don't think I'm a writer. A writer to me is a real person committed to writing. They sit down in their chair every day and they write. And I write on scraps of paper in my purse, and I write on the back of an envelope in the airplane. And I just do it whenever I can.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed to be just pulled together a little bit and refined. But since I don't consider myself, as I say, a writer who knows how to write something in the proper way, I just polish it in my fashion.
Well, I would call it proper in every way that I can see. I think part of the mesmerizing quality is what you say about how you organized it, in that it's very much like human memory. You know, there's one thing that happened in the moment, and suddenly you're maybe 40 or 50 years earlier remembering something, and you remember with such vivid detail that, to me, that part of the book, that's one of the layers, and it absolutely captures and expresses the nature of human memory, I think. And that's a subject that's really interesting to me. Before we go any more deeply into the book, though, I have to ask you one question. Do you still have the jukebox?
We used to have this great old jukebox in the kitchen, and it played opera, and it was just part of the family dynamic, but over the years, our house has been changed, and that jukebox has been moved around lots of different places. And actually, I can't remember where it is right now. That's an interesting point.
Well, that just jumped out at me. And then later in the book, when you're in Tosca's, whenever anyone mentions Tosca's, the first thing I think of is that wonderful jukebox with all the opera on it.
That's right.
That was why I would often go to Tosca's, because I wanted to hear it in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the brand, the type?
Oh, now I just remembered where it is. It's in one of the buildings in Napa. We have kind of a, we call it the cow barn. It's a 9-bedroom, it's a converted old barn that we use for guests and various people who need to come there for wine events or something. And it's up there in the living room. And I don't know what, it's the classic one.
Is that the Wurlitzer with the colors? Okay.
Mm-hmm, with the bubble.
Yeah, the bubbles, that's a Wurlitzer.
Okay.
One of the things that I'm curious about is, as you looked back, sort of this whole overview of your life, especially considering that you kept such great notes, has your life surprised you?
Oh, always. I think that's the nature of life. Has yours surprised you?
Oh, yes.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. The book opens near Mother's Day and near, I think, your birthday is in the month of May, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. We should probably be wishing you happy birthday, either just past or coming up.
Mm-hmm. Just past, thank you.
And with the death of your oldest son, Gio. Mm-hmm. And that forms a thread throughout the book. And I'm wondering, too, if that cover image, it's your family, but with salt pouring onto a hand, an image that you also use in the installation called Circle of Memory. Are those mm-hmm. things as related as they seem to be to an observer like me?
Well, I think that my loss of Gio was, it is the most profound experience I've had in my life. So it's kind of the underpinning of the book of my life since that experience. And the image on the cover is part of the Circle of Memory iconography, really. It's in the center of that, in the darkened space, there's sand or salt falling from the ceiling onto the floor, and the mound grows for the duration of the installation, which is 2 or 3 months, and so it's a growing continuum of building up on the floor. And so this, and a lot of people put their hands in that stream of falling sand.
Oh, they do.
Mm-hmm.
Always. Oh,
especially kids. Uh-huh. They want to like feel it.
And, yeah, yeah, of course.
And so anyway, this is just reflects that. Mm-hmm. Installation.
Let's talk a little bit. Let's describe Circle of Memory.
Mm-hmm.
It was inspired by a visit to Ireland
mm-hmm.
to an old cairn.
Uh-huh. I didn't know what a cairn was, but I went to visit a friend writing a book in Ireland, and she was writing about these ancient cairns, which are 5,000 years old. And they're the shape of, there's a passageway that opens up into a round room with a high ceiling, and it has a kind of a powerful feeling to it, and
mm-hmm.
I wondered if that would have the same, if you could create the same feeling without having to roll stones up a mountain, if you could make it out of straw bale, and I did, and it seems to have still, it's some kind of maybe spiritual technology that we don't understand, but it has a powerful emotional quality to it.
So tell us about how you then translated what you found there into the Circle of Memory. And it was first installed in Oakland, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was it that people experienced, or not what they experienced, what they saw when they went? What was the structure?
Well, it consists of a passageway that you walk down, and since it's all built out of straw bale, you immediately have a sense of the aroma and the texture and sort of the feeling, the quality of the straw. It's sort of evocative. I don't know whether we think of playing in the attic of a barn and bales of hay.
Oh, absolutely. well, especially here in wine country.
Yeah, it has something evocative about it. But anyway, you enter through this passageway and into this round room that is dimly lit very specifically with the light on this falling sand and this fine stream of sand. And there's also a sound element that was designed by Richard Biggs, the Academy Award-winning sound designer. And it has children's voices speaking the alphabet and numbers in 14 different languages. And this tapestry of voices kind of very lightly comes in and out of your awareness because it's set quite low. And there is some experience of in this round circle. It's the roundness of it that seems to be, I don't know if it's womb-like or what, but it's something that's familiar and that we feel at ease in that space and the warmth of the straw. It just is a very reflective place to be. So when you enter, you feel reflective. And although it's meant to be a place to reflect on children who have died or been lost, I think it just causes a person to be reflective. And one person sat down. She said, my father started talking to me. I think it's whatever, it's meant to be interactive and for the experience to be whatever it recalls to the person or brings up for the person who enters it and sits there.
One thing that struck me in the book was that all of the little pieces of paper, because you have, there are pencils and little squares of paper, and people are invited to write the name of their lost child or other things. Mm-hmm. You have boxes of those.
Yes, they write the most touching messages. There, after you leave the passageway outside of the cairn is a wall of straw and a container with paper and pencils, and you are invited to write something if you feel like it. And people do. They leave these messages tucked into the straw, and over the course of it, the installation, there are thousands of messages, and the most just dear, touching messages. Things like, I don't know, Davy, it's been 45 years and we still miss you.
That's the one that gives me chills. That is the one that most struck me in the book, was that one, and sort of the way that time, in situations like the circle of memory that you created, but also I think in spontaneous memory, time just collapses. I think that's one of the things that you experience viscerally in your book. You tell that part of things really quite well. So after Oakland, you've done the installation two more times?
It's been in San Diego and in Santa Fe, and last summer it was in Montpellier, France, in the south of France. And this summer it will be in Salzburg at the festival there.
Oh,
so it's great.
So it's continuing.
It's continuing, and we take the messages from... gather them up each time, and we take them to the next venue. So there's a kind of continuing part of the people who've participated in it. And I think what's been really rewarding is the fact that it seems to be universal. In France, it was in a place where there were a lot of international tourists and people visiting that area. And so messages were written in all different languages, and it seemed to affect everyone. So I felt like it wasn't just me and my... immediate circle, but it has a stronger, more universal appeal.
Well, I think it's absolutely brilliant, one of the most brilliant installations I've ever seen. I went and I put a name in the straw wall, and I took a friend whose son had died, a 15-year-old son. She was quite touched by it as well. Mm-hmm. You've done other installations. I mean, we should say, you don't call yourself a writer, but you write beautifully. You also do art in a variety of mediums. Mm-hmm. So one that struck me was the potato. Art or not art, you have to tell us about that.
Well, in the early 70s, I was interested in conceptual art, and I felt like an opportunity that was being overlooked at that time was commercials were first starting to really be powerful on television, and I felt like for commercials to be the thing, a toothpaste ad, why don't we have something of value, something worthwhile, a piece, why don't we have some wisdom or some art or some something? So I tried to make these 30-second commercials that were about some art, something or other. And one I made was, it was a photographs of a man peeling potatoes and dropping it into the pot, and it had a quote by an artist that I was very enamored with at the time, Joseph Beuys, and the quote was, "Peeling a potato can be a work of art if it's a conscious act." So then I had nobody wanted my commercial. I just couldn't give it away. So I had an installation at one point, and the audience was asked to come in to the kitchen and peel a potato. And then as they walked out, they were asked to put it in a pot. And one pot was art and one pot was non-art. And they had to decide if their potato was art or not.
And what percentage, you know, how did it break down? Did you have many art potatoes?
That was a long time ago. I can't remember exactly. But I mean, it was just kind of just for that little kick of you know, our tweaking our awareness. We were served filet mignon accompanied by miniature carrots and roast potatoes. I thought it odd to be having Western food at a royal dinner in Thailand. As we finished and I was expecting an elegant dessert, an array of platters with Thai foods were brought to the table, including three types of rice. The dishes looked much more delicious to me than what I'd already eaten. My spirits sank. I knew I would be thought unappreciative as I could barely eat anything more.
I loved that. I thought it was really hilarious. You also do costume design. You only touch on that a tiny bit in the book. Mm-hmm. You mention doing costumes for a dance company on a couple of occasions. Couldn't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I had the opportunity to design costumes for ODC Dance Company here in San Francisco and travel with them. And I just loved the company and the feisty, the whole way the company performed and what they were about. And they continue to be about. It's an amazing company. They've grown and survived for 35 years, which is remarkable for a little dance company, led by Brenda Way, who's the artistic director. And she had been in my house, and she'd seen some art in my house in the hallway or something. And so she asked me if I'd do some costumes for her company. And I did for 4 or 5 years, and then I got busy. My life took me other places, but it was a challenging and interesting experience. Mm-hmm. I've always been involved with textiles, and I had a clothing company at one point.
Oh, I don't know about that part.
In the early 80s for about 5 years.
Oh, what sort of things?
It was a line of loungewear that they were kimonos that were designed for Western women with a smaller sleeve and with pockets in the sides and layered, and they were... At one point, they were in 80 different stores and places like Neiman Marcus and Bergdorf Goodman, and then lots of boutiques and things like that.
Huh. I may have seen them. I'm a great fan of kimonos.
Yeah.
And I do remember the period when there was that shift to make them more accessible to Western women so they didn't catch on the bathroom door handle when you were walking
exactly.
out. I've torn several sleeves that way.
Exactly. And make them in layers. I had them layered so that you could wear just the inner layer around as loungewear, or you could wear all the layers and go to the opera. I mean, there were a lot of different kinds of ways to bring that Japanese style to the U.S.
Now, your daughter, Sophia, she had a clothing line, too, for a while, right?
Yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. What did she do?
It was clothing that were things that really young girls would wear, T-shirts and little short skirts and hoodies and fun stuff. And she found that her real customer base was in Japan. She started in the States, but it really took off in Japan, so she found herself going to Japan frequently. And eventually she sold it because she began her film career. But it's still going. It's fun to go to Tokyo.
Oh, it's still going.
Well, she's not involved.
Yeah, but
it's still. Last time I went to Tokyo, I passed the boutique that had it, so store. Uh-huh.
And, of course, her connection to Japan is expressed really beautifully in the movie Lost in Translation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you talk a lot about the experience of that movie in the book, and also of her winning so many awards, which seemed to sort of take your breath away and surprise you.
Well, I think any parent is surprised when their children achieve something, because you're still, I don't think, I always see my kids as, you tell them to put their sweater on or tell them to bring their homework or whatever. So that to see them really mature into these capable adults in the outer world, in the bigger world, is an incredible thrill. In the early 70s, in one of these installation projects, I exhibited Sophia and Roman, and it said... they were in a room, and there was a little cord over the door and a sign that said, "The artist's most important works expected to take 21 years to complete." And I felt like my kids are my greatest artwork, that they're loving and creative and capable and good citizens. And to me, that is my greatest artwork.
Mm-hmm. That comes through very much in the book. One of the tensions in the book, and I don't mean tension in a negative way at all, but one of the dynamic tensions in the book is your attention and dedication to family, including, I love the passage where you talked about how mundane your life felt, going to the hardware store to get keys made and buy light bulbs and all that sort of thing. So that sort of tension of really caring for your family and also being an artist with that inner need to work. So that has that been one of the challenges that you has formed a thread throughout your life, is dealing with that tension of inner and outer?
Yes, I'd say that was a core conflict that mm-hmm. I wrestle with. And I always used to see it as just this struggle, you know, was the family was taking up so much of my time, I didn't have time to do the things of my heart, and how to, you know, resolve those conflicts. But now I see it as a positive tension that is, it makes each one more precious in a certain way, or more relevant to the other. And that's why you'll see in the book there the quote by Tom Waits. Do you remember that?
Yes, absolutely. Please, but retell it.
Well, I don't know if I can tell it exactly, but he's talking about how art and family eat each other, and you know, expressing that kind of conflict, and that
One is always trying to eat the other. It's a constant battle. I thought that was he always nails things so perfectly.
He does, and then he says, you know, he said, but neither is good without the other. He said, we need a sink and a faucet.
I thought about that. It's like a sink and a faucet. Okay, you know, and I think that's so important. I mean, if you take someone who has nothing but time to create their art, I know people who can't do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're paralyzed, almost like writers facing the blank page.
Mm-hmm.
An artist facing unstructured time and no urgency to hurry, because either you have to make money, you have to tend to dinner, you have to drive someone somewhere. Yeah. I think it's easy for it's almost like the creative imagination gets flabby.
That's a great way to look at it. Mm-hmm. There's some truth in that, definitely.
I've found that in my life, and I've observed that in other people's lives. One thing I think we should talk about is your husband, and the interesting way, I think, really fascinating way, you very delicately talk about the sort of imposition people make on you, or the dismissive way they act to either get to your husband or want information about your husband. And I was particularly struck by, I think it was your first OBGYN. And can you talk about him at all? I was just amazed at what he said to you after Gio was born about Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, I think you'd have to read that little piece and put it in context, but I did have this gynecologist when I was pregnant with my first child, and he was in L.A., and he was very highly recommended. And so when I went there, I knew that he really was interested in the Hollywood scene, and I was very careful to kind of skirt around it, because I really wanted him to pay attention to me and my physical thing. But he'd always tell me, oh, I just saw Jane Fonda last week and blah, 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 and I just played tennis with some Paramount executive and stuff like that. So I just kind of avoided talking about my husband's thing. And so anyway, the baby was born, and he came in to see me. At that point, you know, you go to sleep, and then you wake up, and you
have a baby.
You have a baby. I mean, you could have had your tooth pulled. I mean, who knew what would happen? So anyway, he'd been out visiting Francis in the waiting room, and he came in to me and said, oh, you have a healthy baby boy. You didn't tell me your husband was working with Elizabeth Taylor or Natalie Wood or somebody. I can't remember what it was, but he just, his It was just, I was completely invisible, and it was, I was only relevant in relation to Francis's activity.
Yeah, whatever. And that seemed to be, I mean, that to me was the most glaring or most shocking example, but that seems to be a thread that has mm-hmm. just followed through your life. And partly you have a husband who's physically bigger than you are, of course. Mm-hmm. That's almost always the case. But he, when he is exuberant, I've seen him a couple of times, he's like the most exuberant human who has ever lived. And you're small, and you are very well-spoken but quiet. So that's a balance that you two have worked with throughout your, what, 45 years of marriage?
Mm-hmm.
Do you find it difficult at times?
Oh, of course. And I think that's part of the dynamic. I mean, he finds me difficult and, you know, stubborn or slow or whatever it is that that I am. And, of course, those are the extreme ends. And I think it's that, again, a kind of creative tension between those two opposites
mm-hmm.
that also I think is part of the bigger design that you choose an opposite partner and then the children are given several ways to respond to life.
That's a really good That's a really great observation. I hadn't so much thought of it that way.
Well, that's sort of my theory, and that's why uh-huh. I think sometimes relationships break up when the kids leave is because the dynamic was there somehow to bring those two opposing forces into the children's experience, and then it sort of doesn't work after uh-huh. they're not there.
And from an outsider looking at it, it seems like a good fit in so many ways. I mean, two exuberant, outgoing, big people would seem to take all the oxygen out of the room. That, you know, like two perky, a couple where both members are really perky. It's like, oh, I have to get away from them. So, you know, from an outsider's point of view, there seems to be a very pleasing balance. And in my own mind, I think, oh, you must be a refuge for each other in so many ways and, you know, feed each other on some really deep level, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Well, my nature is to be an observer, so that means I'm the audience, so Francis can perform and try out his whatever his thoughts or his creative ideas are, and I'm like a receptive audience kind of person is, you know, part of the dynamic. Mm-hmm. Every entertainer, I mean, he's a screenwriter, he's writing screenplay, and so he'll tell me about something, to, you know, even just to sort of see if I pay attention or am I interested or if I'm bored or whatever, mm-hmm. so... There's a lot of that, I think, in relationships with people who are in the entertainment business.
You are listening to Mouthful on KRCB. Happy Mother's Day. My guest this evening is Eleanor Coppola.
April 16th, 1990, Taormina. Yesterday was Easter. We went to lunch with a group of 25 people that included Dean and his wife, Aurora, Francis, his parents, Jackie and Gia, Eli Wallach, Cordy Willis, the camera operator, and the owners of the location villa. The restaurant was high on a hill with a commanding view of the coastline. Several times during the afternoon, I took Gia out on the terrace to look at rainbows in the dramatic sky over the sea. We sat down at the table at 1:30 in the afternoon and left at 5. The meal began with delicious fresh sardines dredged in lemon and olive oil, served with round loaves of country bread and spicy green olives. They were followed by platters of tender sliced octopus and cheese breaded and fried. Next we had sautéed wild greens with croutons, then a very good pasta arrived, and finally roast lamb with potatoes and vegetables served from deep oval dishes brought straight from the oven.
Those skills of observation that you have don't seem to me to be at all passive. You just seem to catch every little thing. And in that sense, the book and your writing in the book really resonates to me with Joan Didion. Certainly a different subject. She turns her eye to other things. But she's also physically very small and she's quiet, but just a very keen observer. And at times, your book made me think of her writing.
And I like her writing, so Thanks for that.
I love her. Anyone who runs it, there are very few people, actually, who remind me of her. Very, very few. And I was very pleased to start to see that emerge as I read your book. Another thing that resonated very subtly, sort of very like a underground creek or something, I kept thinking about Mary Taylor Cimetti and her book on Persephone's Island about Sicily, particularly the passage about Easter up in a hill town. And it's just such a beautiful, and she brings the whole story of Jesus and his mother, brings it down to a mother and the loss of a son or the loss of a child. And I felt there was a really strong resonance between the way you told your story and the way she described that scene.
That's very curious because I know Mary Cimetti, and we were in Sicily, and I'd met her, and we were there at Easter for the shooting of Godfather 3, and I was by myself, and I went into a church she'd recommended that had particularly beautiful sculpture and interior. And I'm not, you know, Catholic, but I saw this beautiful statue of the Virgin Mary holding her infant son. And I just had this deep, incredible flash. Oh, I get it. This is about a mother whose son died. And I felt this incredible connection to that that icon and that sense of, I was just a mother like many, many parents from the beginning of time who lost a child, and she's kind of the symbol of that loss.
And that comes through so powerfully in your book as well as in Mary's book. So I think there's a natural resonance because it is a universal thing. Time's going by really fastly. I should tell you, you're listening to Mouthful on KRCB, and I'm talking with Eleanor Coppola, whose new book, Notes on a Life, is a perfect read for a mother and for anyone else. It's really a delight. So many things I want to talk to you about, Ellie. One is meeting Marlon Brando. And here's the reason that I want to bring it up. I was struck by what you said, that it was the first time you really understood what charisma was. And we hear so much about charisma. And I read that and I thought, here's a woman married to Francis Coppola, and she understands charisma when she meets Marlon Brando. Would you talk a little bit about when you did meet him?
Yes, it was during the making of The First Godfather, and I hadn't met him until fairly way along in the shooting because I was very pregnant with Sophia, and I went. Once after Sophia was born, she was a couple weeks old, we went to the location. Francis introduced me to Marlon, and I had Sophia in my arms. And when I met him, he just looked at me with, like, such charm and as if I was the most fascinating woman in the world. And just this complete focus of his attention. And I say in the book, I said, it felt like I imagine a hit of heroin to be just immediate and seductive and dangerous.
Yeah, that's a good description. That's how I'd describe it. And I was very touched he took Sophia out of your arms and started looking at her. She said, examining everything, her little fingers.
Yeah. He's a very observant person. You just feel like when he's looking at you, he's like, he can see the stitching on the buttonhole of your shirt collar or something. Mm-hmm. He's just taking in everything. And he did. He, of course, had many children, and he was at ease with children. And he also liked children in a certain way better than adults because they didn't have any preconceptions about him. They didn't ask him for his autograph. They didn't want to say, "Oh, your performance in The Waterfront was my meant so much to me." You know, they didn't come at him as a movie personality. They were just straightforward themselves. And he was always at ease with kids. I would see him sometimes on the set talking to the children rather than the adults.
Let's go back to your artwork, because one of the passages in the book is you gathering some olive branches with olives and taking them into the studio. And I loved the description of the process, and that turned into a big project. Watercolors, you've displayed them. Would you talk a little bit about them?
Yes, those pieces ended up forming a show at the Paula Anglim Gallery in San Francisco. And for me, it was just something I came across or discovered or evolved out of having time to be in solitude in my studio. And I began using olive branches, which I would put above paper and then put a strong light on it. And then on the paper, I would paint the shadow that the material cast, these formed branches. And then I attached the branches to the paper and put the light on, put it on the wall and put the light on it. And so you had the material, then you had the cast shadow, and you had the real shadow. The real shadow and the painted shadow.
Yeah.
And it just kind of formed this kind of dynamic or between these elements.
Where are the paintings now?
Well, fortunately, some of them are in collections. I've sold quite a few of them, and I don't know, there's only one or two left.
Uh-huh. Right now. Are any in public collections? Is there a way someone can see them?
There's one at the DeRosa.
At DeRosa. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's so the DeRosa preserve over in Carneros.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is great. That is nice to know. We will send people there. You know, I could have you back again. I could talk to you for another hour about this book. It's just wonderful, but we are running out of time. Very quickly, you're off on a book tour. Got a lot of places to go.
Well, enough.
Enough.
Yeah.
And do you have any new projects in the works? Any art projects, anything that you're looking forward to getting back to doing? I mean, I know you love solitude. You seem to be one of those classic introverts who you hear your voice in solitude. But are you got anything? Are you in the middle of anything?
Well, right now I'm involved with all the complications of trying to do Circle of Memory in Salzburg. There's always when you try to do something in a foreign country, and the size of the bales is different, or they can't. They have to come from far. Anyway, there's just all the nitty-gritty of designing it, because it's site-specific. It has to fit in a different kind of space. And so I'm involved with a zillion emails and photos and things going back and forth pertaining to that at this moment. And then I do hope in between the time that I'm doing these different book events that I can get into my studio. And I'm at a point where the inner adventure of going inside and exploring your inner world is just as interesting as the outer adventure. I've just been to India, and I've just been to Argentina where Frances is working, and I've had a lot of outer world experiences, and now I'd like to also go down some of the trails of an inner adventure. But I have to be there in that solitude in order to find my way into that next project or the next thing that I'll be engrossed in.
Well, I hope you get that soon. And in the meantime, thank you so much for your work. It's so engaging and so delicate and so touching. It's enriched my life in so many ways. I can't imagine it doesn't enrich everyone's life who comes in contact with it. I hope the book is hugely successful, and I think it will be looked back upon as one of the really great contemporary memoirs.
Thank you so much. That's a great
encouragement. Well, and thank you for taking the time on your tour to come to our little radio station here in the heart of Sonoma County.
Marty's father had roasted a small pig for us, something only done for weddings and festival days. He motioned for us to move our chairs to the table, which was a piece of plywood on sawhorse legs and a sarong laid over the top. There were 8 chairs. I noticed that Marty's wife and I were the only women at the table with the men. The carcass of the pig rested on a board at the end of the table, and all the meat had been carved onto a platter. There was also a roast chicken, a bowl of cooked green beans served with peanut chili sauce, a bowl of sliced mango, a plate of fresh pineapple wedges, and a large pot of steamed rice. There was a spoon and fork wrapped in a thin paper napkin for each of us, and a shallow bowl at each place. I was touched by the efforts the family had gone to create a table and provide chairs and silverware for our comfort, and the expense of roasting a pig and a chicken. Mugs were scattered along the tabletop, giveaway-type mugs with Bintang beer and Kmart locos. We brought two bottles of our wine. It hadn't occurred to us that they wouldn't have a wine opener. Francis started to dig out the cork with a screwdriver. Made's brother disappeared and returned with a Swiss Army knife that contained a small, short corkscrew. It was just long enough to get the cork out, and Francis poured wine into the mugs. The wine tasted okay, but in the warm, humid evening, I found the local beer more appealing. Madi's uncle drank most of the wine.
Able skeever pan at home. It's a black cast iron skillet with several deep, perfectly round indentations used for making a kind of spherical Danish pancake. I've never used this pan, though I stood at my grandmother's elbow often enough as a child as she turned the able skeever with a long Victorian hat pin. I have her recipe for able skeever, but I've never made it, in part because of the shocking amount of butter it requires, and in part because my older sister inherited both the hat pin and the manual dexterity required to flip a liquid ball of batter and keep it in one piece. I often wish that I had taken the time to write down more of my grandmother's recipes. Perhaps you feel the same way. Artist Carrie Gamble actually did take the time to write down her grandmother's favorite recipes, and in 1990 came out with a self-published book called Grandmother's Cookbook. Her grandmother, Elizabeth Rose von Hohen, is listed as the author, while Gamble's name appears as the illustrator and editor. This homey little volume, with its simple spiral binding, hand lettering, and watercolor illustrations, has become a kind of cult classic among cookbooks, and she's just released a new edition. Grandmother's Cookbook perfectly captures the spirit of home cooking in America before World War II. It is a cuisine poised between two worlds, rural and urban, old world and new world. American daughters of late 19th century European immigrants built their cooking from old world recipes learned from their mothers and newer recipes gleaned from friends, cookbooks, and the new glamorous world of advertising. Packaged convenience foods were still in the future, so they used real ingredients, real sugar, real butter, fresh fruit and vegetables. I'm reminded here of journalist Michael Pollan's injunction, "Never eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food." Their food was often recognizably ethnic. As a second-generation American, my grandmother cooked a lot of Scandinavian food. Carrie Gabler's great-grandparents came from Hungary, so among her grandmother's recipes for chicken pot pie, pot roast, and split-pea soup are Hungarian favorites like goulash and plum dumplings. Even the names of the dishes in this book, like cherry roly-poly, shoo-fly pie, and ring-a-lings, are deeply nostalgic. Mixed in with the recipes are short reminiscences written in her grandmother's own hand about her early life in the Pennsylvania countryside. Most of the stories are focused around her grandmother's other lifelong passion, flowers. Lovely hand-drawn illustrations of old-fashioned flowers like wild roses, violets, and wisteria accompany each section. Part of the appeal of this book is how completely unslick it is. You can't fake this kind of homespun charm. The other part of its appeal is that the recipes are easy, dependable, and utterly iconic versions of early 20th century cuisine. Grandmother's Cookbook is as much a historical artifact as a cookbook. As such, it may be of more interest to daughters and granddaughters than to grandmothers, most of whom, after all, cook from memory rather than books. This is Laura Hager wishing you a happy Mother's Day from Mouthful.
That's it for another tasty episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. Meet me back here next week Sunday at 7 for a really interesting interview with Patricia and Walter Wells. Patricia's been on the show several times, and now she's back with her husband. They have a new book that they've written together, We'll Always Have Paris. See you then.
Support for Mouthful comes from KRCB radio members and from the Sebastopol Farmers Market, now open in the downtown Sebastopol Plaza every Sunday from 10 to 1:30 with organic, sustainable, locally produced fruits, vegetables, meats, and cheeses, plus breakfast, lunch, and local musicians. Support also comes from Traverso's Gourmet Foods and Wine, a family-owned purveyor serving customers for over 85 years with domestic and imported edibles and beverages in an old-world atmosphere in downtown Santa Rosa and online at traversos.com. We also have support from Netbooks Complete Net. We also have support from Netbooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86-NETBOOKS. He said, now I remind you, if I may, you all better pay attention.